Jim McGuinness wrote in his book about, and I don't know whether he's changed on this, but as Colin McFadden reached to punch that ball to the back of the net, he didn't want it to happen because they hadn't played to their principles.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
I think they'll go all the way to the final, to be honest.
Yeah?
I believe in Mike Hankey, and I suppose they're good at football, they just have to believe in themselves.
I love playing 12, I love playing 10, I love being on the pitch, to be honest.
Are you confident?
Absolutely not.
Thank you for all the supporters. Thank you for the team. Thank you, France. Merci la France. Merci les baguettes. Merci les croissants. Je vous aime. I love you.
You're very welcome along to Word on the Street. We've had some slight technical difficulties getting in here today. Brona has been stressed to the nigh, but we're here and we're recording. And if you haven't been here before, Word on the Street is a podcast where every week we take a sporting topic, something that's dominating the headlines, and we take it to the public and we find out what they think. So I'm Susanna and I'm here in studio with Eve, and Rachel is on Zoom. Hello. And this this is episode 13, and we're calling it Winner's Curse. So, guys, how are we? Rachel, you go first. I don't want to ask, but how was the birthday?
Look, the birthday started off really well, Susanna. You know, I was having a really nice time with my friends in Dublin, and it took a bit of a nosedive, as I'm sure everyone will be aware. In a bit of shock afterwards, honestly.
Talk us through, in case anyone doesn't know where you were on your birthday.
I was, thankfully, after a big ticket hunt during the week, I was in Croke Park, having a great time. I've been to an Ireland before, back in like 2013, but never like with my, like that was with my family. It's never with my friends. Like, it was really good to experience, but first half, nervy. I've never been so nervous at a match. and then the second half, I'd reason to be, clearly. Yeah, it was just didn't get firing, and Cork were beaten out the gates. But look, it happens.
Yeah.
Not often or ever before, but it happened. So I'm over it now. I very kindly was asked to cover the tip celebration all day the next
day.
That
was so funny. You're on your private story where it was like a video of the whole tip team celebrating, and then it was like me, Cork fan, the day after, asked to cover the tip celebrations. I was like, that's actually harsh. That's a cruel and unusual punishment.
Yeah, you know what? It was actually nearly better, because like by the time lunchtime rolled around, I'd heard tip so often. I was over it, you know, exposure therapy.
Yeah, fair enough. And you, Eve, we were at the game as well, but we weren't at the game. We were at the grounds.
Covering the fan reaction, because as someone who has no skin in the game, like I'm from Westmeath, we are not a hurling county at all. I just like the atmosphere. Apologies, Rachel. But the atmosphere after the game was amazing. And so many, like, obviously, Tip won, 2019, their last All-Ireland? So a lot of the adults, they've been here, kind of done that. But there was a lot of, like, little kids, and this is probably the first All-Ireland that they were either A, alive for, or B, kind of remember.
Yeah.
And, oh, they were so hyper. They were so excited.
It was sad. I was staying at my brother's house, which is like a 5-minute walk from Croker, and I was walking along, and I left maybe 10 minutes before the game ended, because I was like, oh, I'll get there in time. And the hordes of Cork fans just walking down the street at me that have obviously left early because they knew it wasn't coming back, and they were so sad. It was actually, it made me sad. That's how sad they were. And most of them I tried to interview and they were like, nah, it's too soon. I can't do it. I was like, you know what? Fair. I don't blame you. But I did get one fan, and this is kind of what's led us in to this whole topic this week about curses and superstitions, because one fan I chatted to, she thought that Cork were cursed.
I think we're cursed.
You think you're cursed?
Yeah, I think we're cursed. We haven't won in All Ireland since I met my husband. Limerick, Cork, Tipperary. That's where we live, just in the three county border.
Okay.
And so we have neighbours that are up here today. My best friend has a little fella this age. She wouldn't watch a match with him. She's Tipperary. But I knew it was weird because she had to get a ticket last minute. They knew.
Something in the water. That was so bizarre. I didn't really know where she was going with the whole conversation when we were having it. But basically, if you didn't fully understand, because I don't think Eve did when we first listened to the clip, it was basically she was saying that her friend, who was a Tip fan, never watched any hurling games. But just before the final, she felt like there was something in the air and that they were going to win, and she had to get a ticket. And then they did win, and this Cork fan now felt that there was a curse on Cork, and it was just a bit bizarre. And I felt like,
I feel like it's so many fans are like that. I've felt like that many times over the course of my life. Not being, I don't know if I can fully relate, Rachel, to the, I'm sure, the heartbreak of Sunday, but as a Tottenham fan, there was only this year, only just in May, we end like our 17-year trophy drought, or however long it was, like 13 years, whatever it was. And every single time that we'd be in a final and we'd lose, I was like, maybe it's my fault. maybe if I stopped watching, we'd do better.
I have had that before,
yeah.
Where you think, you don't watch like someone kick a conversion or like a point in tennis,
yeah.
And you cover your eyes and then they get it. And then you think, oh, okay, well, it's because I didn't watch.
Yeah.
So for the next, like, 10, I'm not going to watch.
Like, I know we'll get onto the golf a bit later on, but I remember when McIlroy was doing the kind of his last tee for the Masters. Now, obviously, it had to go to a playoff. He didn't win it then. I couldn't watch. I was, like, on my floor with my hands over my eyes. I was like, I can't watch the screen. It's so stressing me out. And I feel like if I watch him, I'll be putting more pressure on him, even though it's over a screen.
I know.
And he's thousands,
I feel like,
of miles
the whole
away.
Nation felt that way actually watching that.
Very much so.
But Rachel, you had a bit of a different opinion when you listened to this clip, did you?
Yeah, I don't agree with the Corker curse at all. I think it was just a massive malfunction on all systems that could have occurred on the day. You know, proper Murphy's Law, anything that can go wrong did go wrong in the space of one half. You know, not even across the whole game. So, no, don't think it's a curse. It's a big stage as well, All-Ireland final, as with any final in any sport. So I think there's a dangerous little line between teams underperforming in finals because it's the biggest stage you can play on and saying, oh, you know what, we're cursed. We're just going to take that out of our hands.
Yeah, do you think it's a bit of a cop-out just to say, oh, well, It's a curse. You haven't won in 20 years. It's the curse of the whole of Cork.
I think it's a coping mechanism more than a cop out. Maybe that's what you mean by cop out. But I think, you know, she was so upset and she had her little boy with her and he was crying. And I think they were both so upset that it was almost a way of being like, don't worry, Cork is still class. We're just cursed. Do you know?
Yeah, I'm like, when you mention curses in the GAA, the first thing everyone thinks of is Mayo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's your prime example. And that's one I can kind of get behind. It's like,
really?
It seems like, yeah, you know, there's a proper story around it. Whereas on Sunday, everyone was just like, ah, not cursed, because that was a really shocking performance. But with Mayo, you know, that's a bit of like folklore behind it.
What's interesting about the Mayo curse, and for anybody who doesn't know, it's that in, was it 1951,
I think,
that the last time Mayo won the All-Ireland, the footballers, they came home and they weren't respectful to a passing funeral.
Yeah.
And then a priest cursed them and said, you know,
ran after them, apparently.
Yes. And then until all the players associated with this team had passed away, you wouldn't win another All-Ireland. And since then, I think the last player passed away in 2021 or 2023. And that they haven't made a final since the last player has passed away, I suppose, is my point. So the next time that Mayo make an All-Ireland final, that's when we can prove if the curse is real or not. Because if they don't win, then it's just that they're not very good at football right now.
Oh, ouch. I did read that somebody did like a book on the history of Mayo. I can't remember the author's name. And he went back and he interviewed a bunch of people who would have either been there or known somebody who was there. And nobody can confirm that this happened.
Yeah.
Nobody brings up the curse until somebody else brings it up. It's not something that's in the living memory. And then also somebody looked at the funeral records and apparently there was no funeral on the day that the team were meant to be passing through. So
and
it's also potentially a bit of a coping mechanism that was made up in like the early 2000s because Mayo just kept losing and they needed a reason.
And what's really funny is that people, you know, from Mayo, they're so sad. Our team never win All Ireland. The women do.
The women do. Yeah, they forget about the women.
The women won.
The curse clearly doesn't apply to women.
No, they won four All Irelands in 5 years between 1999 and 2003. So if you want a job done,
get the women to do it. Absolutely. But all of this talk about curses got us thinking a lot about superstitions.
Yes.
And there are some mental superstitions in the world of sport. My favorite one. Bruno is our producer. I always mention her as if she's just on the pod, but if you don't know her, she's our producer. She's fantastic. But she was sending us in a bunch of superstitions in the world of sport. And my favourite one, I think, is Serena Williams, who I'm not sure entirely sure if this is true, because I tried to, like, you know, like a good journalist, triple source it and double check it. And I couldn't find it in a lot of credible places. But she apparently wears the same pair of socks throughout an entire tournament without washing them. Now, that is disgusting.
Yeah, but it's repeated a lot. It could be a little bit of a myth. She maybe did it once. But what she does do definitely is...
Yeah, there are some that she's admitted to.
Tie her shoes in a certain way, yeah. And bounce the ball exactly five times.
Five times before her first serve and twice before her second.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because I was reading something where she was interviewed about her superstitions. And she said, if I'm losing, I'm not losing because I didn't play well. I lost because I didn't tie my shoe the right way. And it's totally ridiculous because I have to use the same shower. I have to use the same sandals. I have to travel with the same bags. And then when she lost the French Open in 2012, she was convinced it was because she didn't stick to those rules. So she said, I didn't tie my laces right and I didn't bounce the ball five times and I didn't bring my shower sandals to the court with me. I didn't have my extra dress. I just knew fate. It wasn't going to happen. And she did lose.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you're playing such an intense mental sport, I feel like you can't risk even the littlest things maybe going wrong. And if these routines bring you comfort, like Rachel, when you're playing a match, do you have any like pre-match rituals for camogie or anything you need to do?
Nothing as like some of my teammates have like religious ones that they stick to, but I would always have to say like a little pet to the dogs before leaving, like
aww,
religiously, you know. And I remember once or twice like my dad being like, you know, take the dogs for a walk, like they're staying here, thanks very much. You know,
what if you're not coming from your house, or are you always, you have to be coming from your house?
I always had been, yeah, because I haven't played championship here, I suppose, in a couple of years. So I'd always been coming from my home house. But it's an interesting one when you compare like superstitions and routines, because when I was doing a bit of research on this, and I think you spoke to the sports psychologist today, she talked about the danger of not knowing the difference between what's a superstition in that it's something you do that might have any effect on what happens and what's a routine, something that actually like sets your mind up for your game.
Mm. That's similar to what you were talking about with Nadal, isn't it?
Yeah. So Nadal, for anyone who'd watched Nadal play tennis, he had a very specific routine kind of before he went on the court, where he'd have to line up his water bottles exactly like next to each other. And then before he served, he would do like a kind of a hair tuck, a shirt tug, and he'd wipe his face.
Put off the opposition or something.
Yeah, and he said, he has a quote here from his autobiography. He said, tennis is such a mentally aggressive sport that anything external I am able to do to distract, I always do it. So I think there's two different versions of this. There's, you know, these mental games that players play to kind of put themselves maybe a bit of edge against their opponents.
Mm.
And then there's something like the Serena Williams example, where it's that players have to do for themselves to feel that they play right. And so for this pod, we asked our audience if they who play sports have any of these kind of superstitions. And we got a response from Megan, who plays Gaelic football.
I've been doing this superstition for a good 10 years at this point. When I play in goal for soccer or Gaelic, I always pace out the width of the goal mouth and mark off the halfway point and then midway between that mark and the posts to divide the goal mouth into four equal sections and mark those lines on the ground. The width of the goal never changes. It's always 12 paces across, but I do it every time I step foot on the pitch. It started out as a way to make sure I knew where the centre of the goal was for my positioning, but now I do it regardless of if there's already marks on the goal line. I also tap the base of each post twice with each foot while I'm pacing it out, just to hear the noise of my boots on the metal and ground myself on the pitch before the match starts.
The way she even talks about that is a bit...
It's very regimented.
Very regimented. But hers is a funny mix between, it started, I think, as that kind of routine thing and as a reason to help her in her game. But now it's almost bordering on a superstition, maybe?
If it makes her play well, if she feels like this is what I need to do to ensure that I'm concentrating, that I'm playing well for this game, would it be nearly detrimental to not do it? Would you suddenly perform? And that was what I was interested in finding out from an expert. So for this podcast, we got into contact with Dr. Kate Kirby, who has worked as a senior sports psychologist with Sport Ireland and the Olympic Team Ireland official kind of psychologist. and she's been working with them for years. And we wanted to ask her kind of about the psychology behind athletes and their superstitions. So this is what she had to say.
They're really common in sport. I guess the differentiation that I always make is this a routine that's controllable and contributes to performance? So, for example, you know, doing visualization, you know, writing notes, journaling, listening to certain songs or music, doing your warm-up in a certain way. They're routines and they allow people to kind of get into the right physical and mental shape to perform at their best. And the important thing is that they have they're controllable. So those things like journaling, doing visualization, maybe even saying a prayer, a lot of athletes will use their spirituality. All of those things are controllable. You can do them wherever you are in the world, at whatever time of the day your competition is on. But superstitions are much more about investing or having a belief that your outcomes are dictated by other factors. So like where you sit on the bus or what you eat, you know, eating a really specific type of food or going to a very specific restaurant or wearing a specific type of clothing. And those things are much less controllable. And when you stand back and think logically about them, like assuming that you're going to play well or poorly because you sit in a certain seat really removes your own agency from your performance. So I would definitely encourage athletes to have routines and a consistent way that they prepare to perform, but to rely less on superstition and, you know, believing that their performance is as a result of, you know, wearing a certain piece of clothing or sitting in a certain place.
Yeah, I think the element of control there is something that she focused on a lot and that I found personally interesting, because I don't remember having any specific superstitions when I would play like football or when I would do anything like that. But I definitely had those kind of superstitions, like exam time in school and all the way into college. I had to wear my hair in a certain way for exam time, and I had to make sure that I was wearing like this necklace I had to wear for exams. And if I didn't, I was like, oh God, I'm going to do horribly here. And it's kind of an easy thing to make you feel better. So I understand why she can acknowledge that. But at the same time, you do need to train yourself, because if for one day I forgot this necklace.
Yeah.
Suddenly, that makes no material difference. But then you could be negatively impacted on a mental level. I like what she said, though, about routines and kind of visualization. That was really interesting, because like for a lot of sports, I think the one that comes to my mind immediately is something like Formula One, where drivers work really hard mentally on, like, say, closing their eyes and being able to visualize not only kind of what they want to do for their career, but like a specific track. And it's all about getting as mentally calm and concentrated as you can. Like, so for like Rachel, I'm interested in kind of when you're playing matches and trying to get into that sort of level-headed space. Like, do you, like, have you ever worked with a sports psychologist, or do you know people who have? And are these the kind of methods that they're kind of being taught?
Well, we actually just recorded one day too soon, lads, because we've got a session with one this evening. Would you believe?
That is so funny.
So, I know.
Is this your first session with a sports psychologist?
We've had more like workshops with them, and, you know, even in college and stuff, we would have had like talks from them. And control, as you mentioned, always comes up. It's making sure that you're not putting the outcome of the game in something that's completely out of your control. Even though it is, you know, everyone knows that no matter, you could play the best game of your life and you could still end up losing, but it's that you're not going in with the preparation that if something completely out of your control happens, you're going to say, well, we're going to lose now because they didn't get to do X, Y, Z. And I had a look at, with free taking, probably in GAs where you see it most, you know, people line up their frees, but in golf and rugby as well, people have to line up like that in the middle of a game. And when you look at like Dan Biggar from Wales, he got into his head that he had to do this. The twitches. Yeah. It just happened in Qatar. I think he said he was really hot, so he was kind of like relieving himself of like the jersey, and it made him feel really comfortable and he kicked really well. So he ended up taking up this as part of a routine, kicked really well in the World Cup, but he got loads of abuse for it. Mm. And he said it really affected him. That's and so in the end, he ended up scrapping the routine. So he had to overcome being like, this isn't why I'm not kicking the ball well, because I'm touching my hair. You know?
It's kind of a similar, what you said there about not carrying things into a game, because then you're almost prepping yourself to lose, you know, if you put too much pressure on it. And it's really similar with the case, just when you were talking about rugby, it brought to mind the whole Irish rugby quarterfinal curse that they talk about. The fact that, you know, Ireland have never made it out of a quarterfinal of a World Cup. And although they say over and over again that they don't think about that and they don't let that pressure into their bubble and they don't carry it into a World Cup, you can't help but think something's going on in the mindset there, that it's playing somewhere at the back of their head as they go into that quarterfinal. And then...
Well, it's so funny because... when they, you know, if they keep saying, no, we don't think about it, it's because that's an answer to a question of, do you think about it?
Yeah, it can't help that the media keep bringing it up.
Exactly.
But it is interesting because I think it's been three times that Ireland have topped their pool. Mm. So twice they've been world number one going into a World Cup. They're favourites. They top their pool. They do the hard bit.
Yeah.
And then they get into a quarterfinal. And not that the quarterfinal isn't hard, but then they manage to stumble at that hurdle. It is just a little, yeah. Consistently, it is, I mean, I don't believe in curses, but it is bizarre. It has to be something with that mentality.
Yeah, and you can see that with like certain football teams. I hate to keep bringing up Tottenham again, but the more years that went by without winning a trophy.
I keep bringing up rugby, so.
Yeah, it's like the more years that go by, it's like, oh, well, maybe we're just never going to win a trophy. It's not in our blood. We're Spursy is the term that was used. You know, you're always going to fail. You're never going to be able to.
That's so harsh.
Yeah, I know.
They made a word about failure based on Spurs, basically.
And not anymore, baby. not anymore. But yeah, well, I was interested in hearing about this sort of quarterfinal curse with rugby, and then as well with Leinster being so successful.
I was just
going to
say that Spurs thing makes me think of, or what you were saying about Spurs makes me think of the case with Leinster, how they keep winning and then manage to lose. At the top level every time.
And we had a voice note in about this.
Yeah.
As
Mick.
Well.
Mick. He's back. And this time he's talking rugby. He talks all sports, but here we go. We'll listen to him about rugby this time.
Is there such a thing as winner's curse? I think there is to an extent. If you look at, say, Leinster in the rugby and many other teams throughout the years where before tournaments or championships, I suppose public commentary has been, oh, such a team is going to, say, for example, if it's Leinster Rugby, oh yeah, they're going to win the trophy, they're going to win the final, they're going to be champions, and they have two hands in the cup before a tournament or final is even played. This definitely has to affect players, and I think it does also seep down through the layers and kind of embeds itself deep in the roots of the psyche of a team. And I think it's very hard. Like, we often hear of outside noise and outside the bubble and any distractions. But definitely, I think winner's curse is a thing.
Yeah. I don't know with Leinster. You feel like maybe it's the fact that they don't get enough competition leading into the big moments. And then when you get to the big moments, you don't know how to switch mindset and deal with suddenly a team who are actually, you know, your equal, or maybe even not your equal, but much better than what you faced before. And now you can't shift your mindset and you can't shift your game. I'm sure they talk about it. That's what I don't really understand.
Yeah, that's why I think the idea of what is, obviously there are no such thing as curses, so it's all mental, right? So we know this. So it's all about how they are approaching games like that. And that's why, again, I wanted to talk to Dr. Kate Kirby. So Mick was very insistent that there was kind of a winner's curse.
Yeah.
Dr. Kate Kirby had a slightly different perspective on this, obviously. But she came from a kind of her psychological background on what she believed about this kind of, can you get complacent when you're winning so constantly until a certain point?
Yeah, I suppose the question is do you have strategies for managing pressure? So a lot of teams, when they're very dominant, or athletes when they're dominant in their sport, they don't get pressure tested that often. And that can be problematic because you don't get opportunities to practice and refine how you respond when the momentum has shifted away from you or you're coming from behind. But I guess all you can do in that respect is not assume that's going to continue forever. Have a strategy for a time where you experience a setback or the opportunity opposition are going through a purple patch, or you have a player sent off, or your best player gets injured. You have a strategy, you have a tactical plan, and you have a mindset or an emotional control plan that you execute in anticipation of things not going smoothly. So I don't know if it's necessarily concentration. I think it's probably just not always go this well, and having a plan ready for when the momentum goes against you.
And we've never seen this so much in play as this year with Limerick in the hurling championship. Mm. I mean, you mentioned sports psychology in Ireland, especially in GAA and rugby, and Caroline Currid is the first name that's on everyone's lips. You know, she's iconic, especially in terms of victory within GAA, All-Irelands with Dublin, Tyrone, Tipperary. And the 3 years she wasn't involved with Limerick, they didn't win an All-Ireland final. And they spoke about this recently enough on Off the Ball Breakfast. And there was questions asked, like, is that what happened this year? Because when Limerick lost to Dublin, not to take anything away from Dublin, they were fantastic. They played the game of their lives. They looked so lethargic. They looked so sluggish. And you wonder, is that a Caroline Currid? Is that where a sports psychologist comes in? Mm. Because, I mean, they won four in a row. So if we talk about the winner's curse, they had eliminated that, basically. You know,
yeah.
They were the best team in the country for 4 years in a row, and they were able to maintain that. And then all of a sudden you have this influence dropping out of their team, and they're losing. And yeah. They're losing to teams that on paper they really should be beating.
Yeah. But it's a similar concept of, do you think there was pressure on them to perform in this All-Ireland because they had won so many before?
Well, there would have been pressure any other year, and yeah. They still won. You know, they still managed to win four in a row.
Yeah, so it's interesting. It's how you shape your mindset going into it. But it's interesting you said the word lethargic, because that's what I feel sometimes seeped into Leinster as well, is that they already thought that they were going to win, and they would, I'm sure, argue against this. And like, who am I to say what the coaches are telling their players and how they feel? I'm sure they feel differently. But I just wonder, in the back of your mind, do you have that kind of subconscious voice being like, oh, we should win this. We've won so many. This is just another game. And what a sports psychologist does is they unlock that part of your brain. Maybe they bring it out and then they defeat it and deal with it, rather than just letting it niggle away at you. And then, like Limerick, maybe when they didn't have that voice helping them think through those kind of things, it just, I don't know, maybe it kind of took over, or maybe they just didn't think it through properly. Maybe they didn't deal with the demons almost.
Especially coming off the back of that Munster final against Cork, you know, a huge blow to take, losing against penalties. It's a bit of an anomaly. That's when you need someone to come in and say, right, this is how we reset.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's similar, moving on to golf.
Yes.
I know you want to get there. Kind of a similar story with Rory, except
yes.
Similar to, I don't know, he kind of defeated all the pressure and now there's new pressure.
Yeah.
And he's not defeating that new pressure. It's weird.
Rory is an enigma.
Yeah, Rory is an enigma.
I saw somebody tweet over the weekend. I don't know if you saw in the Open when he like made a shot and a golf ball just had been buried in the ground right underneath.
Oh, yeah, I did see that.
This kind of golf ball magicked out of thin air, seemingly. And someone goes, he has never played a normal round of golf in his life. And I feel like that's just the story of Rory McIlroy. He achieved this incredible victory at the Masters, okay, career Grand Slam, and everyone was saying he is going to have the weight of the world off his shoulders. This is going to be a Rory McIlroy reborn.
Yeah,
but that carries so much pressure in and of itself. Like, it's everyone just saying to you, "Oh, so you're going to be brilliant now?" Instantly, you know, you're going to be Rory McIlroy, who's already incredible. You're going to be like version 2.0, even better.
It felt like he didn't really care about that pressure, though, coming off the back of the Masters. Like, he did look relaxed.
Yeah, he did, but he's not playing any significantly worse than he...
Well, he was initially. Remember that first tournament after the Masters that he was with Lowry?
You have to give a bit of time for a Masters hangover, nearly.
Yeah.
But he did pretty well at Portrush.
Yeah.
So we asked Nathan Murphy, our resident golf expert.
Nerd.
Yeah. Thank you.
He kind of had an interesting take on this whole psychology surrounding the pressure that's on that was on McIlroy's shoulders and kind of still is on McIlroy's shoulders. Mm.
Hello, Word on the Street team. Nathan here. I think we're being very harsh on Rory McIlroy if we're talking about him and a winner's curse. It is 100 days since McIlroy won the Masters in a career in golf that can last anywhere up to 40 years. Rory McIlroy is going to be playing at the Open Championship for the next 25 years. He's going to have chances to win that in the next quarter of a century. I can understand why we're all maybe a bit deflated by what's happened post-Masters. Part of that was because of the major calendar this year and that the next major was going to be at Quail Hollow when that hosts regular PGA Tour events. McIlroy is so dominant there. He's won four times. The fact that the Open was in Portrush, his favourite links course in Ireland. I think we all maybe lost the run of ourselves a little bit as to what might happen next and maybe not fully appreciate what McIlroy had achieved at the time, which is something very unusual, which is to have a gap of a decade, more than a decade, without winning a major and still manage to achieve that goal. So, yes, there's been a sort of peculiar reaction from McIlroy himself in that I think we all thought that he'd be freewheeling for the rest of his career now and that he'd walk around with a big smile on his face. And there was an issue at the PGA with his driver where he had to change that and he was upset with the media. But I think having been up at Portrush last week, Rory is back to himself.
Rory is back.
Well, I agree. You know, he was never going to, you know, come straight out of the Masters and win like the next three tournaments. That would just be unrealistic. I think right now, unless your name is Scottie Scheffler, it's pretty difficult to win anything.
Before we jump into Scheffler, Rachel, I want to get your thoughts on McIlroy, because even I did a pod about it before you joined the Word on the Street team, but I've never actually heard your opinion on him and all the pressure that's been surrounding him.
Yeah,
not to put you on the spot.
There we go.
Yeah, so come on, out with it.
Was I looking a bit too relaxed for you?
Yeah, you were. You hadn't heard your voice in a while.
Yeah, he was incredible to do what he did. I really was in the camp that he's going to bid on now and he's going to be unbeatable for the rest of the year, because you could see when he was walking around, like, he had the weight of the world on his shoulders, and especially with all of the LIV golf debacle that he kind of spearheaded that in the couple of years before. And you just thought, right, he's not chasing this thing anymore. He'll just be able to play for fun. But it wasn't the case. And maybe he did just need even a month or two off just to say, right, I've done that.
Yeah.
Let's get back to a bit of routine like we've been talking about.
And maybe he is playing for fun. Maybe playing for fun doesn't necessarily mean you win every golf tournament.
Yeah, because the idea of what players play for is something that's been in the news with golf kind of this week. Because Scottie Scheffler, who has just won the Open, is the world number one, is arguably the best player of his generation.
He was ridiculous in Portrush.
Stupidly talented.
Yeah.
And he gave this sensational press conference where he basically said, I don't really know why I want to win this golf tournament. It's not giving me great satisfaction, because you get a few minutes of, yay, I've won, and then you're on to the next tournament. It was a really interesting insight into pressure, into kind of mental state. We talked all this pod about players and athletes' mental states, and this was so utterly unique. So we're going to throw again to Nathan, but also we're going to hear a bit of Scheffler himself.
Now, what Scottie Scheffler said last week obviously adds an extra layer of context to what McIlroy achieved, in that it does feel that everything that kept McIlroy at the top for the last 10 years was that drive to win the Masters. It's what got him up in the morning. Whereas Scottie Scheffler is different, it feels, to almost every leading golfer, maybe even every leading sports person, and that he doesn't seem to be motivated by the silverware, by the outcome. The reward for him is that he's working his ass off his entire life at golf. And that's why he wants to win, to justify all the time that he has put into it.
I'm not here to inspire somebody else to be the best player in the world, because what's the point? You know, this is not a fulfilling life. It's fulfilling from the sense of accomplishment, but it's not fulfilling from a sense of, like, the deepest, you know, places of your heart. You know, there's a lot of people that make it to what they thought was going to fulfill them in life. And then you get there and all of a sudden you get to number one in the world and then they're like, what's the point? And, you know, I really do believe that because, you know, what is the point? You're like, why do I want to win this tournament so bad? That's something that I wrestle with on a daily basis. It's like showing up at the Masters every year. It's like, why do I want to win this golf tournament so badly? Why do I want to win the Open Championship so badly? I don't know, because if I win, it's going to be awesome for about 2 minutes. And then we're going to get to the next week and it's going to be like, hey, you won two majors this year. How important is it for you to win the FedEx Cup playoffs? And it's just like, we're back here again, you know? That's why I talk about families being my priority, because it really is. You know, I'm blessed to be able to come out here and play golf, but if my golf ever started affecting my home life or it ever affected the relationship I have with my wife or with my son, you know, that's going to be the last day that I play out here for a living. You know, this is not the be all end all. This is not the most important thing in my life. And that's why I wrestle with, why is this so important to me? Because, you know, I would much rather be a great father than I would be a great golfer.
That's such a different outlook. It's almost hard to predict. Will that give Scheffler a longer career span than everybody else when there's not going to be as many ups and downs?
As Nathan said, that's a whole different kind of winner's curse. And I'd love to delve into it, but unfortunately, we don't have time. But Nathan does do Golf Weekly and the Ryan Line every single week. And that's actually about to kick us out of the studio. So if you want to hear more about Scottie Scheffler, I'm sure they're going to be talking about it. But quickly, before we give up the studio, sorry, not give up in general, I want to hear everybody's word in the studio. Curses or no curses? What do we think? Rachel, you go first.
I thought you were taking Scottie Scheffler. What is the point? Way too there.
We give up.
No curses. No, cop out. You're crumbling under pressure.
All right.
Yeah, no curses. But if you don't do a superstition, it can mess you up. I think they are real. You can make yourself have a bad day.
Yeah, I think no curses. But I do think it can be a niggle in the brain that you've lost this over and over again. Are you going to lose it again? Like the Irish quarterfinal, for which my heart is still broken. Anyway, that is the
end. Carlin Curd is with the Irish rugby team this summer. You'll be happy to hear, Susanna. So. Oh.
Thank God. We're building into World Cup 2027. No more quarterfinal curse. Alrighty, that has been Word on the Street this week, and we can't wait to chat to you next week.
I think they'll go all the way to the final, to be honest.
Yeah.
I believe in Mike Hankey, and I suppose they're good at football. They just have to believe in themselves.
I love playing 12, I love playing 10. I love being on the pitch, to be honest.
Are you confident?
Absolutely not.
Thank you for all the supporters. Thank you for the team. Thank you, France. Merci la France. Merci les baguettes. Merci les croissants. Je vous aime. I love you. Hey!